We'll wait just a second, Ms. Skolnick, so we can get the shift accomplished.
Sure, Your Honor.
All right, our next case for this morning is Westmoreland County Employee Retirement System against Parkinson. Here from Ms. Skolnick.
May it please the Court. The fundamental issue in this case, Your Honors, is about the Delaware duty of loyalty. If the directors failed to meet that duty of loyalty, then they failed the Aronson standard because the business judgment rule would have been rebutted, and they would fail the RAIL standard because there would be a substantial likelihood of liability. There are three short points I'd like to make which show that the district court's decision actually found that the plaintiffs satisfied demand futility under Delaware law. First is...
Can I just to clarify, though, we are speaking about adequacy of pleading. I mean, there's... which the parties have sparred a little bit about what the proper standard of review is, and I know you've argued extensively that it's de novo standard, but we're just talking about materials, A, in the complaint, and B, in the other materials that the parties all seem to have agreed were before the court, like those affidavits.
That's correct, Your Honor. We are at the, as Chancellor Strine called it, the most friendly plaintiff standard and the least friendly to the defendant standard of the case. First is the dimensions of loyalty under substantive Delaware law. The cases that we cited in our brief, Hyatt, which incidentally was recently reversed on alternative grounds, and Massey and some other cases, show that under Delaware substantive law, the Delaware directors must try to comply with the law. It's a target that they have to shoot at.
But your theory for why they didn't comply with the law relates very closely to this consent decree. And one of the things I'm interested in knowing your position on is how you can characterize Baxter's response to this consent decree as violative of the law when they did spend quite a bit of money, in the end, $337 million, trying to get these colleague pumps to work. That's a lot of money for a subterfuge, it seems to me.
I agree with you, Your Honor. That's a lot of money, and I do not believe it was a subterfuge. We do not allege that it was a subterfuge initially. These directors, when they – and all the directors in 2006, except for one, was on the board at the time that we filed the complaint. They knew about this consent decree, and they tried. They shot at the target of compliance. They tried and missed for several years, 2006 and 2007, and probably for quite a bit of 2008. What we allege, Your Honor, is that in November 25th, 2008, when Ulatowski tells us that the FTA got disgusted, really disgusted with their inability to remediate this pump, and they said, we're not going to accept the statistical data. You must, demanded is the word he used it. The FTA demanded that they submit a clinical trial with their next submission, 510K submission. At that point, Your Honor, management decided to throw in the towel. We're not going to do it. We're not going to do a clinical trial.
Now, what was your theory of gain to Baxter from this? The district court asks you that a number of times.
Yes. If I can answer your first question first, and then I'll go to the gain, because they're somewhat related.
All right.
The expenditure of money, the considerable expenditure of money, if we look closely at the complaint, paragraph 94, at the it's either 94 or 96, at the expenditure of money, we could see where when it was expended, and that actually substantiates our case. In 2006, from 2006 to 2005, I'm sorry, to 2007, Baxter expended $185 million on trying to remediate. Then on 2008, they expended $125 million, quite a bit of money. But when you look at when they expended it, Your Honors, it was in the first three quarters. There was nothing expended in the last quarter, nothing expended after November 25th, 2008. Then you look at what they spent in 2009.
$7 million?
$27 million, about one-fifth of what they expended the year before. And this is the year when they should have been gearing up and ramping up and expending a lot of money on the clinical trial that the FDA demanded. But you know what? They threw in the towel. Management did. And then we know that the board did, because we did a 220, as Delaware courts beg us to do, and we got the minutes, and we know that the board was advised at the absolute latest in February of 2009. They were briefed by Parkinson, CEO Parkinson, who incidentally was the CEO at Abbott, so he knew, he was very familiar with the FDA's
history, yes,
and the importance of adhering to the FDA's orders. And what he said at this at the meeting was that he briefed the board about the FDA new regulation, new, looking for the exact word, but it was a here, the update of the colleague pump, including as well a recent meeting with the FDA concerning the proposed remediation plans. This was in February. The recent meeting was in November. We have every reason to draw that reasonable inference. These are sophisticated, well-advised people who do not write minutes to create liability. So it's a fair, in fact, it's only, probably the only reasonable inference that in February of 2009, they were advised of the FDA's new requirement for clinical trials. At that point, a loyal board would have entered a resolution saying, do the clinical trials, because we have to comply.
Micromanaging for a board, I don't know. I mean, do boards dictate clinical trials all the time?
Boards have to dictate. This is the importance of Delaware law. They have to dictate compliance with the law.
Was the consent, was the clinical trial a legal requirement?
Yes, the clinical trial was a legal requirement in this way. The way that the consent decree was implemented in 2006 because of a failure to adhere to the law and the regulations, the law being the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and the regulations being Part 820 and different parts of the Act. So the FDA, the law sets a standard, the FDA implements it in the regulations, the colleague pump was defective, violative of the regulations, so there was a consent decree. So the consent decree required compliance with the law. And what the FDA says, Your Honor, it's an interest, your question goes right to the heart of the matter, whether what the FDA says you must do is tantamount to a law. And again, under Delaware, it is. We know this from the Massey case. The Massey case was a coal mine disaster where what the board did in that instance was flout the regulations of the whatever regulatory body oversees mines. And what Vice Chancellor now Strine said in his own very peculiar, in his own particular way of speaking, is that you can't violate what the regulators tell you to do. They are the regulators, and they're telling you what the law is.
That would be a dramatic change in governmental and corporate culture in the United States, wouldn't it, if suddenly every corporate board must, at the risk of personal liability, comply with instructions from regulators without being able to challenge them?
No, I'm not saying that they can't challenge them. There can be, Your Honor, exactly what was probably going on in 2006, 2007, and the early part of 2008. Back and forth, challenging them. Hey, we're trying to remediate. We're not quite getting it right. Let's do this. Can we do this? But November 25th, we know it changed. There was demand, and there cannot be defiance of an order from a regulator, and that's not a novel law.
It's the formality of the order. I mean, I'm having visions of every phone call from somebody at the FDA, putting the board at risk of failing to abide by its obligations. You're saying you don't mean that, but what do we have here specifically alleged that tells us that it is at a level of formality that should alert the board that the rules have now been set?
Several things, Your Honor, and your question is well taken. We have Hugh Latowski, who is the head of enforcement, so he's not a low-level person. His affidavit, of course, is compounded by Betty Collins, who is at a lower level. They were meeting with the CEO and other executives at Baxter, and they were telling them several things that are unrebutted in the record. One is we demand that you do clinical trials because you haven't gotten it right yet, and we want to see the evidence.
One of the things you're saying is that it's the highest possible level of people at Baxter, and it's a very high-level person at the FDA.
And another thing I'm saying, Your Honor, that I'll add, that's correct. But another point is it's the exact same violation that was at stake in Abbott. In Abbott, it was an 820 violation. Now, 820 is the quality assurance. It's a regulation. And it's the quality assurance that a pharmaceutical manufacturer has to provide that its products are of adequate quality in accordance with the FDA's construing the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And in Abbott, there was a series of warnings about 820 violations. And in Baxter, one of the provisions of the consent decree is that you are in violation of 820 because your manufacturing quality assurance standards are inadequate. So it was the exact same regulation that was at stake in Abbott. And furthermore, Your Honor, the back and forth, to-ing and fro-ing with the FDA, you know, we're not sure what we have to do. They didn't make it real clear. We didn't know. That's exactly what was said in Abbott. When you read the district court's decision in Abbott, it refers to the fact that how could Abbott possibly have really known that they meant business now because they've put up with so many violations for so long? It's almost exactly what the district court judge said here. How could they have known? Well, they could have known. We know that they could have known because we have Ulatowski's declaration saying they did know, and we also have the board minutes saying that the board was briefed. So this case is actually cannot possibly be reconciled with Abbott as well as Delaware law. The same regulations, the same to-ing and fro-ing, the same regulatory body, but there is a reasonable inference, or I'm sorry, a reasonable doubt that the board violated, knew that they violated the regulations, that they accepted management's throwing in the towel. They did nothing about it. They did not act when they had to act. And they also threw in the towel and knowingly said, we're going to violate the regulations. Now, as
in your rebuttal time, it's up to you if you want to save a little bit.
I'll save a little bit.
Okay.
Thank you.
Choice. Ms. McDevitt.
Good morning, Your Honors. Just like to make a few points in response to my opponent's argument. First of all, on the standard of review, plaintiff asserts that this court in Abbott adopted a de novo standard. That's absolutely incorrect. The court in Abbott had issued an original opinion in 2002 in which it did adopt the de novo standard of review, citing the Delaware Supreme Court's decision in Brehm. The court then vacated that opinion and issued the operative opinion in 2003.
But the standard of review and the standard of pleading are certainly federal issues to be determined under federal law. And this looks to me like whatever the height of the standard may be for 23.1, we are evaluating this very limited set of documents, the complaint and some of these other things that have, by consensus, been added on to it. So I don't see how it could be anything but de novo. We're not in a position to resolve factual disputes.
Well, Your Honor, certainly the panel could adopt a de novo review. I'm just saying that under the prior precedents, the standard was abuse of discretion, and that's even clear from the Abbott decision and the fact that the court vacated the original opinion, and the principal difference between the 2002 decision and the reissued decision in 2003
yeah.
to reiterate the standard of review. But
I accept that that's your position. I am concerned a little bit that in everyone's zeal to talk about demand excuse, this is sliding way over into the merits. It seems to me that the plaintiffs have given quite a bit of information about demand futility from their 220s, from other things. And since the only question is whether this case is going to go forward as a derivative suit, why isn't this enough? What more do you think they could have put in?
Well, stepping back, Your Honor, they have to show that their theory is that the board is not disinterested because the directors face a substantial likelihood of personal liability. Baxter's directors cannot be held liable for breach of their duty of care. Plaintiff doesn't concede otherwise.
Duty of loyalty, though.
Yes, so they have to show a breach of the duty of loyalty. Okay, their theory is that the board breached its duty of loyalty by consciously deciding to stop complying with the consent decree in 2008.
And there's some interesting material in the record. This is why it may be of some importance, whether it's de novo review. Because if you look at the documents, both in the complaint and also some of the frequently asked questions, it appears that the longer the recall was delayed, the less money Baxter had to pay, because it was a depreciated amount on each one of these machines that were still out there. And there was a floor, but, of course, each year the depreciated amount goes down. That's depreciation. So playing a time game as of 2008 was a way of saving money. And, you know, in the meantime, the company is working on its alternative pump, that's the one I suppose that replaced this with, at least from Baxter's point of view. But there's a theory that actually does suggest that there was a breach.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the plaintiff's theory is one that Baxter violated the consent decree.
Right.
And the board knowingly caused Baxter to violate
right.
the consent
decree. The board knowingly said, we're just going to shut down, right. because Baxter could have, if Baxter had decided as of the end of November 2008 that the colleague pump was just unfixable, and Baxter had made quite a few efforts, as I say, I see this in the record plainly, to fix it, and it wasn't working. They could have just recalled them all then, just done exactly what later on got done by the FDA's order. But Baxter doesn't do that. Baxter kind of drags it out for another 2 years while these things are out there being dangerous to people.
Well, Your Honor, as far as like the two parts of this, the violation, there's no evidence, there's no well-pleaded allegations of fact that even suggest that Baxter violated the consent decree. And I state that because when the FDA orders the recall in May of 2010, it issues a press release on May 3rd. It issues a questions and answers document on May 7th. There is no statement whatsoever in either document that Baxter violated the consent decree.
But why is that conclusive? I mean, this is, again, this is at the pleading stage, and we're trying to figure out whether demand was excused, whether it would have been futile to demand the board. I tend to think, actually, that this all collapses into the second part of the Aronson test because of what you were saying about the restrictions on duty of care liability, but putting that to one side, if they just stop doing anything to try to fix it and don't recall, why doesn't that violate the consent decree?
Well,
Your Honor, you could have easily negotiated with the FDA an agreement that they wouldn't say so out loud in their press release. I don't know why that's binding at this stage.
The FDA also did not impose any fines in connection with the recall, which were authorized under the consent
but they
decree.
They did impose the buyback, and so they may have thought, you know, to the extent they wanted Baxter to be paying money, it was better to require, $558 million paid to the people who still had these pumps to try to facilitate their transition to a different device, right?
Your Honor,
it felt like there was no money. It wasn't just a little slap in the wrist. $500 million strikes me as a fair amount.
The FDA explained in its releases that the primary problem with transitioning hospitals to new pumps was the customers were reluctant to give up these pumps because they liked them. They thought they worked well. In fact, they're sold overseas, still unused. Baxter could not just go in and take these pumps out of the hospitals. They were owned or leased by the hospitals and medical facilities using them.
You know, product recalls happen all the time. And if somebody is told this drug is, you know, dangerous, or this car is going to blow up if you run into the car in front of you, you know, yes, people own their car, but if they get a product recall, then most people will respond to it, and so I'm not sure that argument gets us anywhere.
Well, the hospitals would have to have alternative pumps, And that was part of the problem that's discussed. I mean, the FDA could have ordered Baxter to recall these pumps back in 2006 instead of entering into the consent decree. And it later explained the reason it didn't do that is because these are medically necessary devices. There weren't alternatives. There
weren't. Baxter wasn't the only company in the market making pumps.
No, it certainly wasn't.
I mean, you made that point in a different context.
That's correct. They certainly weren't, but there weren't sufficient pumps. So the FDA made a decision that it was better to have these pumps in the market being used than to order them to be recalled and to have Baxter attempt to remediate the pumps, which I think the record shows Baxter was trying very hard to remediate the pumps. They had multiple meetings with the FDA over the entire period. The board, plaintiff itself, puts into its complaint excerpts from the over 60 board and committee meetings at which the board was apprised of the remediation efforts and discussed them. Plaintiff describes the very substantial charges that Baxter incurred, and I'd like to point out, Your Honor, that a charge is not the total amount that Baxter incurred. You know, as I'm sure Your Honors know, a charge is over and above what was budgeted for. So that's in addition to just the normal expenditures that the company was making. So the company was spending very, very significant amounts.
So you didn't put any evidence in the record. I mean, that's the problem. You know, again, they have alleged that the efforts to fix it dropped off to practically nothingness as of the end of 2008, early 2009, and yet the pumps stayed out there for another 2 years.
But they have no well-pleaded allegations of fact that support that conclusion.
They find more facts than they found. I mean, essentially you're saying until you've proven your case and your complaint is deficient, and I'm very uncomfortable with that theory.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying they needed to prove it, but under Rule 23.1, they had to plead particularized facts that support a conclusion that efforts dropped off in 2008, and I'm saying their well-pleaded allegations of fact refute that conclusion. They show that the board continued to meet. They show that the board continued to approve substantial charges. In fact, the largest single yearly charge was in 2008, the very year that plaintiff alleges that the board decided to stop complying.
Yeah, but we just heard that stopped by the third quarter, and the critical move came in November. So does that really advance your argument?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'd like to turn to that alleged clinical data requirement.
In paragraph 94, which, you know, we're looking at right here, mm-hmm. which makes it clear where that $125 million comes from. So,
yes.
Go ahead.
And now, on appeal, plaintiffs are relying principally on this alleged clinical data requirement. As we point out in our brief, they made no argument about that below whatsoever. You can search their response briefs to the motion to dismiss, and you will not find the words clinical data in there. They've completely waived that argument. But even so, first of all, Ulitowski and Collins do not speak for the FDA. They were not the principal people at the FDA. They were not the principal people in charge of any clinical data requirement. As their declarations show, clinical data, if it were required, would have been required in connection with submissions of 510K filings, which are under the Office of Device Evaluation, so a different portion of the FDA. So there's nothing to suggest that this so-called requirement was set in stone in November 28th or that the directors acted in bad faith by not complying. And I'll point out there's many difficulties with clinical data, not the least of which is in obtaining informed consent from plaintiffs who in this case are critically ill. So the fact that Baxter, as Ulitowski and Collins acknowledge, argued for a different form of testing in a simulated lab situation does not suggest bad faith. It suggests they're trying to comply with the consent decree. And interestingly, when the FDA orders the recall,
the question is, could an inference be drawn that it is? It's not, is that the inference that's going to even get past summary judgment or whatever? I think the sense of your argument is that there is a way of looking at these facts that's favorable to Baxter. And I agree with you as far as that goes. But the question strikes me is there a way of looking at these facts that's favorable to the plaintiffs?
Your Honor, I think there is not a reasonable inference from the facts alleged that Baxter stopped complying with the consent decree in 2008 or that the board consciously made a decision to stop complying with the consent decree. If they had, why were they were meeting up through March? They submitted their latest round proposal for their latest round of corrections in April 2010. If they decided to stop complying, why would they continue meeting with the FDA?
Well,
why would they
buy time, I suppose, given this depreciation, although I'm not sure what else. But it's a question that bothered the district judge, for sure.
Well, the district judge found, though, that the reasonable inference from the facts alleged, including plaintiff's own allegations and the Ulatowski and Collins declarations that plaintiff obtained from the securities case, is that Baxter was working very hard to try to remediate the problems with the colleague infusion pump. And this is a very complicated medical device. And, you know, as the FDA says, when they ordered the recall, these problems were not just affecting Baxter's pump. I mean, this was something that affected infusion pumps industry-wide, essentially. And the FDA, at the time of the recall, announces that it had just started a new initiative about the safety of infusion pumps. And also, when the FDA orders the recall, the FDA gave Baxter then 2 full years to complete the recall, you know, which certainly does not suggest what plaintiff tries to imply, that this was something that was killing people on a daily basis. It was a medically necessary device, and there was time necessary to transition to others.
Okay. Your Honor. Thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Skolnick?
Just a very few things, Your Honor. First, the argument that this was not a violation, that the consent decree was not violated. The three R's, the refund, recall, or replacement, was implemented under paragraph 15 of the consent decree, which is only triggered when there's a violation of the consent decree. Secondly, the language that the FDA uses, they seem to be a polite agency. They mentioned the effort of Baxter to comply. Is the identical language that they mentioned the effort of Abbott to comply. Third, in addition to the point of depreciation and running down the clock as a reason for the throwing in the towel, as I call it, the additional reason that was alluded to, Your Honor, is the Sigma pump. We have in our complaint mentioned that CEO Patterson talked about, Parkinson, bragged about this new generation Sigma pump, and he said it will soon be brought to market. I suspect that once we're allowed to do discovery, if we are allowed to do discovery, the monies were expended on a clinical trial for the new pump, and they just turned away from the FDA orders on the colleague pump. A fourth point is the reasonable doubt. Is there a reasonable doubt that the directors lacked the requisite fiduciary duty of loyalty? And, Your Honors, when you read the opinion, you see that actually Judge Tharp found that there was a reasonable doubt, although he made such a clear error of law that it wasn't that it came out in a convoluted way. If the point, if you look at page SA 18 through 19, which is, I think it's page 17 to 18 of the opinion, Judge Tharp finds that it is the complaint doesn't rule out the possibility, which means that it is a possibility, it is a reasonable, it's plausible, that the directors may have decided not to remediate, and this is a quote, because remediation may have been more costly than the recall ordered by the FDA. What he says there is that he made a finding that it's reasonable to think that the directors maybe did a cost-benefit analysis. And that cost-benefit analysis, Your Honors, is completely violative of Delaware law. By making that finding, it's not only that he made a clear error of law that should be corrected, but he actually found that the plaintiffs have satisfied their burden. because he found that there's a reasonable doubt, a reason to doubt that the directors acted loyally, because there's a reason to doubt that they were not even shooting at the target. They were cost-benefiting the analysis and decided, let's violate and see if we can get away with it. And Delaware law says you cannot do that.
Ms. Skolnick, could you respond to the waiver point?
Yes, I can, Your Honors. There was no waiver of the Ulitowski
clinical trial point.
Or the clinical trials. The relevant case that I have to cite to Your Honor is, it's Bailey.
How about referring us to the district court record?
Mm-hmm. Yes. In the district court record, we asked, when we admitted the Ulitowski and the Collins declarations, we asked that the district court take judicial notice of it, which he did. And the decision, we mentioned in our opposition brief, we talked about the delay, because Baxter was saying, we didn't know. How are we going to know? How did we know that the FDA really meant it now? And we focused in our brief on that portion that Ulitowski said, we told you that your remediation effort is unacceptable. We did not focus on the clinical trial, but we did not waive it, because under Bailey versus International Brotherhood, 175 Fed Third 526, there can be no waiver where a declaration or an affidavit is part of the record. There was a skeletal argument made on it, and the district court mentioned it in his opinion. And that's exactly the situation here, so there was no waiver.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.